This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. If you need any more information, head to FUBARradio.com.
Pitch Talk with Olivia Cox and Rachel Zanni.
Well, hello. Welcome to Pitch Talk. My name is Rachel Downey. Olivia Cox, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. I just got the fright of my life because for some reason, even though knowing we were going live in about 3 minutes,
we've been here over half an hour in the studio waiting
on tenterhooks, I completely forgot. And then the music came in, and I think it's maybe my headphones are a bit loud.
Mine are really loud,
but it's good.
It's keeping us alert.
Loud and clear coming through on the airwaves.
Well, we are here Tuesday. Although, people, doesn't it feel like a Friday? I have no idea what's going on. Could you tweet us at FUBAR Radio and agree with me?
I've got an idea about this. I think it's because we were lulled into a false sense of security by Easter.
Yes, I'm with you.
Then, so we had 2 4-day weeks in a row. Then we had my birthday last week, which, let's be honest, everybody felt was a bit of a holiday day.
Yes.
So this week, having 5 days on the trot, it's a little tricky.
Very difficult for us. It's clearly difficult. Olivia, what have we got coming up on today's show?
We have got, so the Commonwealth Games, of course, have come to a close. So we're going to be talking to Olympian James Goddard. And we've also got an interview with Ryan Terry. Now, if you don't know him, have a look on Ryan's Instagram, because he's the only person I've ever met with a million, bang on a million followers, which was quite exciting. And he is a bodybuilder / physique model / gym bunny, I think is the best way to describe him.
It's a very good way to describe someone.
In sport news, in the F1, Daniel Ricciardo took his 6th Formula One win in the Chinese Grand Prix on Sunday. Ricciardo came from 6th place in under 20 laps, passing the likes of Hamilton and Vettel after Red Bull chose to pit for fresh tyres under the safety car.
Amazing.
Good call.
This season has started fantastically, purely because, like I said last time, Lewis Hamilton is not winning. Mercedes is not a foregone conclusion. First of all, Daniel Ricciardo, incredible driver. He really is. He's really showing his worth. And that overtake was fantastic.
It was. And it really drew light on some of the other drivers who made some less great choices, which caused a couple of crashes. Brendan Hartley, unfortunately, was the outcome of one of them, him spinning off into the gravel. But yeah, Ricciardo, they keep referring to him as a young driver, but I think now he's sort of earned his stripes.
I think he has somehow. He's not just turned up out of nowhere.
No, he's doing really well. And bless him, I do like Vettel, but I think it's actually quite exciting to see someone other than Vettel taking control, because he's consistently up there doing really well, and to not actually be getting on the podium is quite interesting.
And, you know, talking about Ricciardo, seats are expected to become free at Mercedes and Ferrari kind of towards the end, obviously, of this season for the next season. Mm. And it's been suggested that Ricciardo could join Hamilton at Mercedes as they push for a 1-2 finish in 2019. How incredible would that be?
That'd be awesome.
That'd be a force to be reckoned with, surely.
Yes.
So then it'd be a foregone conclusion again. So.
I mean, there's something to be said for Ricciardo maybe following Vettel.
Yeah, very true. But I think hopefully this season we'll see more of his worth, and people will stop saying, like you say, like he's a new driver or that come out of nowhere or this or that. People will actually see his worth.
I think it's because he's young.
Yeah.
I mean, young in age, not young in experience, because he, of course, was doing really well in some of the Formula 3, Formula 2 drives and LMP3, LMP2. So he's earned his weight on the track.
He has. And the other debate is whether or not Hamilton will stay at Mercedes, especially, number one, obviously, what he charges, how much his contract will be worth. But also, with the trouble that's going on with Mercedes at the moment, it says here Lewis Hamilton's team will return to their base today for tough talks after failing to win any of the first three races.
Yeah.
He's not in the best place, Hamilton, at the moment. His car's not performing well, tyres not doing what they should, and then the strategy went against him.
Well, I mean, they were a bit unlucky with the safety car because Red Bull really cashed in on that.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, for whoever's fault this is, or maybe it's literally just luck of the draw, it didn't work for Mercedes. But interestingly, in other motorsport news, Sam Bird.
Yes, amazing.
Won Formula E. Sam Bird, this is my nice little segue, being that he used to be Lewis Hamilton's reserve driver at Mercedes. So you can see that there is a lot of talent and a lot of skill in some of these I hesitate saying younger drivers, but the drivers who perhaps don't have the main seat.
Yes, the drivers that maybe don't have the financial backing behind them to make it into F1.
Yeah.
And I think, and do you know what? It's funny, when Formula E started a couple of years ago, we've had Mitch Evans on the show, when Formula E started a couple of years ago, I don't know if people really took it seriously, electric car.
I think there's still a slight feeling that it's just not motorsport. The real petrol heads,
yeah.
The noise, the smell, the atmosphere, you don't get that in Formula E. I mean, it's pretty goddamn quiet.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's still exciting to watch because of the drivers.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's different. It's still not. But
it's a completely different race. I mean, I went to see the guys in the paddock a couple of years ago, actually, when they were doing it in Battersea Park. And even just having two cars, they have to do that car change because the cars can't keep going for that length of time.
No.
And it's not the same. But having said that, when you're then watching however many, a grid full of cars going around the Formula One track, you're just thinking, oh my God, the atmosphere. Actually, let's be honest, probably most people aren't thinking that. But it occurred to me this weekend.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, I know before when I've spoken to people about how much I love motorsport, I don't think you can truly fall in love with it unless you go to a race, like you say, and you're there and you hear the noise and you that smell.
It's more than just watching the cars.
Yes.
Even though when you're there, it's kind of difficult to see much unless you look at a big screen because they obviously whiz straight past you.
Yeah.
It's the atmosphere. It's the whole thing.
Yeah.
And that's why I think Formula One is so successful.
And sticking with Formula E, retiring from F1, we've got Nico Rosberg. He is now joining the all-electric racing series, formerly as an investor and shareholder. He says part of his motivation to get involved is for environmental reasons. Since my retirement, I've become very interested in the e-mobility movement and its potential to positively impact our society and our planet. How amazing.
I mean, there are quite a few people who have been silent partners or just sort of slid under the radar sponsoring a team. Leonardo DiCaprio has a team.
Can you imagine getting a gig? You're like, oh, here's your managing director, Leo.
Oh my God. I mean,
you'd have to play it cool and pretend you didn't know who he was. That's what I would have
to do.
I don't know. I'm a bit of a loser when it comes to
things. Interestingly,
like this.
You say that. Now, this has got nothing to do with Formula One or Formula E, but something to do with something we talked about last week. Meghan Markle.
Yes.
God, I always say her name wrong.
Meghan
Markle apparently was set up on a blind date with Prince Harry and claimed not to know who he was. Apparently, that's what won him over.
She's good.
I know.
She's so good. That's what I'm going to do then.
Well done, girl. Yes. I mean, the fact that you had posters of our royals plastered over your childhood bedroom is, you know, it's by the by. We'll let that go.
It's coincidence. It's coincidence.
Totally coincidental. Okay, should we move on to football? I know you're chomping at the bit for this one.
I'm chomping at the
bit. So Man City have won the Premier League. They won the title on Sunday as Manchester United lost 1-0 to West Brom. The top four teams will, of course, qualify for the group stage of next season's Champions League. Rachel.
Foregone conclusion. Over to you. You're like, and go.
That's my football
done. Yeah, like City, it was a foregone conclusion. They were going to win anyway. It was just a matter of time. They probably are slightly disappointed with this because of Man U losing, because of the point system, City automatically won. It's amazing, but they probably wanted to be playing and winning that game when they then realised they've won the title. And then a lot of people are saying, City is a little bit of a man-made team. Everyone's been saying this for years. City wasn't even in the Premier League years ago until money was invested into the club. And then they had the money to buy the players.
But surely that is the nature of football with all these transfers.
It is, but literally this club out of nowhere became what City is today. It was no kind of gradual rise or anything like that. But now people are saying, well, it's what to do with the money they're spending. No, Pep Guardiola has done an incredible job with the team. And it's taken a little while. Last season, they didn't do that
I mean, yes, it's to do with the money and yes, it's to do with the manager. But fundamentally, any decision to buy a player surely comes from the manager.
All depends, really. It depends what kind of shackles they've got. Some managers don't have a say, you know. It's very, very difficult sometimes.
It's a political sport.
It is. It really, really is. And, you know, sometimes that's why managers get frustrated and leave.
Right.
I used to work for a football club on their channel. I've probably mentioned this before. I don't know why I'm being coy.
I think you have.
I've got a very big mouth. It's not like me at all to be coy. And if the football player upset the manager, that was it. The football player was gone.
Huh.
But that manager left Chelsea very soon afterwards. So there we go. Very quickly, and also I'll mention the West Ham Stoke game last night. Stoke almost won their first game in 10 games, but they didn't. West Ham won last night. Relegation zone. I think it will be Stoke that will be relegated because this is the relegation battle, basically. So we've got about, what, 5-6 games left of the season. The higher end, so second, third, fourth for the Champions League is very exciting, and also the lower end, who's going to be relegated and then who's going to be coming up. So yes, and obviously tonight we've got Brighton Spurs playing. We've got all the Premier League games going on this week, because this weekend is FA Cup. On Saturday we have Spurs Man United, Sunday we have Chelsea Southampton. I would very much like to see Spurs win a bit of silverware, please. We'll lose Poch if we don't get some silverware. Very quickly, the last bit of football I will share with you. Football fans are, well, they're risking playing crazy prices for World Cup tickets. One England-Tunisia game ticket price, I don't think that's an actual sentence, it's going for £11,000.
Wow.
To watch England. Now, I like to sometimes put my daily rate up, but I would never put it up to that price. £11,000. I wonder if people... It'll be corporate. I think corporate companies will end up paying for that.
Corporate companies?
Yeah.
As opposed to...
As a non-corporate company. But yeah, I think that would have to go for... I mean, who's going
to
spend £11,000?
I'm surprised they're allowed to charge that amount of money.
Is that
regular ticket sales, or is that through reselling on the black market?
Is it StubHolly? So yeah,
StubHub.
Yeah,
StubHolly.
What
on earth is that?
I don't know. But
are we now advertising some random
on the black market? but yeah, no. It's not like you're legit. So yeah, it's someone who's bought it cheaper and then selling it on a little bit more expensive.
I really don't agree with that.
I don't. It should be capped, but it's madness. £11,000.
Think how much you could buy for that.
I am
at least a car. Maybe a car and a half.
I'd buy two.
Depends what car.
Yeah, it's true.
Moving on to the Commonwealth Games, because very shortly we are going to have Olympic and Commonwealth swimmer James Goddard on the phone. So much happened during the Olympics. Obviously during the Olympics, during the Commonwealth Games. We did speak to Jazz Curlin ahead of the Games. Sadly, she walked away without a medal, but England came second in the medals.
Amazing.
And a really, really strong effort. There's been some chatter about a bit of disappointment between some of the, not only the athletes, but the nations. Scotland didn't do particularly well. But that's the nature of the beast, surely.
Yes, I totally agree. And it's weird, because we touched on this last week and, you know, saying, yes, we're second in the table, but isn't that fantastic? I would like to... I don't know, I feel like it's just going to be quite quiet now after this.
It is. And I wonder if we're going to see more sporting opportunities come up. Obviously, after the London Olympics, there was a huge surge of really getting our young people into sport. And some of the press that's been around these Commonwealth Games has been really saying that actually there's a lack of females in sport who have the confidence to excel in sport. And I think it's quite empowering to see how well some of our teams have done. The England netballers... Probably the greatest result in their history. They scored in the final second against Australia.
It's incredible.
To give England a 52-51 victory. And it's stories like that that come out of the Commonwealth Games, which, let's be honest, Commonwealth Games is a bit of an underdog to the Olympics. And seeing something like that is just awesome.
Yeah, and I love the fact that as well, you know, they've said, head coach Tracy Neville has said that funding is still a noose around our neck. I know Gail Emms, who's an ex-badminton player, she was gutted that they cut badminton funding. And now we're looking at this with netball. We just assume, you know, I've got here a spokesman for the Sport England said its funding must primarily focus on the amateur game, with projects that help former players get back into the sport and develop a walking netball program which helps older people or people with injuries play. I just don't think there's enough money coming into the sports anyway.
I think you're right. I think, unfortunately, there's a huge gender bias, and I think money goes into primarily male sports. Mm-hmm. And if you look at netball, the primary team of netball is female. It's taught as
we've been
a
doing
female
great for a while.
Sport. Yeah. But you would hear football, oh, women's football. But you hear netball, and it would have to be categorised men's netball. And I think that that is a huge reason why they are not attracting the funding they should be.
Yeah. And it's, you know, they always say it comes down to revenue. And I get, say, with the Premier League, why that will have more TV exposure than women's football. But it's growing, and it is a tough one when it comes down to the revenue. Right. Next one.
just aware of time all of a sudden.
Well, I think we're very, very soon going to have James Goddard on the phone. Just while we're getting him on the phone, I wanted to share with you my favourite moment, a big blooper that happened during the springboard, men's 3 metre springboard diving event. Now, there's an athlete whose name is just going to not roll off my tongue. Ahmed Amziar Asman.
Say quickly, perfect.
Now, he belly flopped. And it apparently, someone's been counting this, and it is his second belly flop since the 2016 Rio Olympics. So there you go. Three belly flops on live national, international, in fact, TV. I bet that man's got a really sore belly.
Yeah, it's a sentence you don't hear every day as well, isn't it? What a belly flop, eh?
what a belly flop. And your third to date, mate.
Yeah.
Well done.
Good work, good work. Right, we will have a few more stories. I also want to touch on, when we talk about marathon, we'll talk about the Boston Marathon as well a little bit later on. But I believe... on the phone line right now, we've got James Goddard. James, hello.
Hello. Hi, Rachel. How are you?
I'm so good. James.
Hi.
We've also got Olivia here as well. Olivia.
Hi, James.
James, Olivia.
Hi, Olivia. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Fantastic. Yeah, I'm really great. Yeah, really great.
Do you know what? James and I, we spent a lost summer in Thailand a couple of years ago, which sounds a little bit random, and we had a very good time. James, you were teaching swimming out there, weren't you?
Yes. Teaching swimming, coaching swimming, everything to do with swimming, that's kind of my bag, so it was great. And it was great to have you there as well. You were doing everything to do with journalism, right? Teaching the kids about journalism. I was trying.
I think at one point I played my showreel to the kids because I went back and I didn't know what to do.
Hey, every like counts. Get them on your Insta.
Exactly. It's got to be done. James, you represented Great Britain at 2004 Summer Olympics in Athens. You've also represented Great Britain at 2008 Summer Olympics. You've also presented the 2002 Commonwealth Games, and the 2006 Commonwealth Games and 2010 Commonwealth Games. I'm out of breath again just saying all this.
And 2012 Olympic Games. I did my home Olympics as well.
Boom. Let's definitely get that one in there, James. James, what was that period like for you, first of all? Before we touch on the Commonwealth Games that's just gone, what was that like for you as, you know, a swimmer coming through and representing your country on that level?
It's kind of like, I mean, for the Olympic Games, if we're going to just have a little chat about that, that's like the pinnacle, isn't it? That's like the be-all and end-all for a swimmer anyway. You know, it's different with different sports like football and basketball. Maybe it's not so much, but for something like swimming, it's like the pinnacle. So to kind of like go to three Olympic Games was like a dream come true, really. That when I was younger, when I was about 13 years old, that's kind of when I watched one of my teammates make the Olympics and win an Olympic medal. And I kind of decided right then and there, wow, I want to go to Olympic Games. So to qualify and make it there was really a dream come true. It was a special time. It is amazing. And the Commonwealth Games is amazing as well, but we'll talk about that, I guess, in a sec.
So 13 years old, you had a teammate who went to the Olympics. How early did you start swimming?
So if you speak to my mum, she'll tell you that I could swim from the age of two, but mums tend to over-exaggerate a little bit, don't they?
I thought you were going to say, she'll say I came out swimming.
Came out swimming, yeah. If you spoke to my mum, she would say, no, I joined my local club at about 5 or 6 years old.
Wow.
And to be fair, I was really lucky, to be honest. I was born in a country called the Seychelles, and it's just a group of little islands. So I grew up like on the beach and the sea and hotel swimming pools. So I learned to swim from a very, very young age. And when I moved to the UK when I was five, it's weird. My dad's from the Seychelles, my mum's from Stockport. Weird combination, I know.
mind-blowing.
Really weird combination. But when I was five, I came over here and I literally joined my local swimming club straight away and got in the water.
Wow. And so therefore, when did you kind of decide, I want to do this as a career, or did it decide for you?
I knew from a really young age that I wanted to do sport, literally from in primary school. Like, I did so many different sports. You know, that was one of the great things that I've got to really thank my mum, because I played football, tennis, cricket. Swimming, obviously, I did cross-country running. I did loads and loads of different sports. My mum taxied me absolutely everywhere to do all these sports. But I think probably from around the age of 13, especially watching my teammate called Graham Smith. He made the Atlanta Olympic Games and won bronze in the 1500-metre freestyle. And watching him do that, that's when I really kind of clicked in my head, you know what, wow, I can do this as well.
And what are the nerves like? I know it sounds a stupid question, but do you feel the pressure that you're representing your country, or are you unaware of the fuss and attention on you?
It's a weird question. It's a good question because
James. That bit of feedback.
Dead to me, James.
It's a really great question because obviously it's really nerve wracking. It should be nerve wracking because you've got to get them nerves to kind of get the adrenaline going. It means you care, all that sort of stuff. But at the same time, you've got to kind of treat it like just a normal competition, if that makes sense. So like when you go to the Olympics, you don't want to eat different things, you don't want to try different things, you don't want to change your stroke, you don't want to change your warm. You want to do absolutely everything that you've always done throughout the whole of your career, because why change things for the Olympic Games? You've got to stick to what you know, stick to the routines that you're used to. So at the same time, it's really nerve-wracking, but on the other hand, it's just another competition. It's just a pool with water in it, it's just a lane that you've done it a million times. So there's kind of two ways to look at it, maybe.
So do you still swim for pleasure? Because we've spoken to a couple of athletes who've said, actually, no, they can't think of anything worse than what they used to compete in, because it is a job. And it's so fascinating to see these people who, as you say, you've loved it from basically when you're able to walk. Do you still love it?
I'm gonna be honest, and I'm gonna say no. but just only because, like you just said, like I did it every single day for 30 years. And when you finish, it's like, because the training is so grueling, the training is so hard, and it's kind of like you're in this, your own little bubble. Do you know what I mean? You're only in this like swimming bubble world. And that's something that I've really enjoyed actually since I've finished swimming, is meeting new people, like meeting people like Rachel, like when we go away to Thailand together, like we do a bit of work together. I would never have done that in my swimming world. I'd have just met like coaches and other swimmers, and we'd have talked about training and blah blah blah, and it's like, oh, boring. After 30 years, it's like, it's done. You can go out, meet new people and have new experiences. So I don't love it anymore. I hate it.
I love this. So something else that we've been talking to a lot of people about is the fact that in England, or in the UK in general, it's chronically bad what a small minority of people can swim, or at least children can swim. So you probably are one of the lucky few who really learned to swim at a young age. And to you, it must be, I was going to say, a bit like walking, but probably like riding your bike, like something that just comes naturally. Is that something that bothers you, knowing that our younger generations aren't being taught to swim?
I mean, using the same quote again, but it's a life-saving skill. It's the only sport that is actually a life-saving skill. So to hear kids not learning to swim, and then you hear of kids drowning, and like I said, me and Rachel have just done a bit of work in Asia, and it's even worse over there, and those guys, especially in Thailand, there's lakes and rivers and, the sea, obviously, and they all live right near all this stuff. So in this country as well, I always encourage kids. I've got a 9-year-old daughter, she's nearly 10 now, and I'm taking her training tonight. She's going swimming tonight. And she can swim, she can do all the strokes now, and she's got in a little club as well. But netball's her thing to me. But I would always encourage parents to get their kids in as soon as possible into the water, to build that confidence, learn to swim. So then, if they fall in a river or a lake, or even if like parents going on holiday and they just want to chill on their sun lounges and have a cocktail, they don't have to worry about their kids jumping in the pool, and having a good time. They don't have to like keep their eye on them the whole time. So it's a great life-saving skill. Get your kids in as soon as possible.
That's a bit like parenting maths there, isn't it?
If you put your James Goddard.
Put your kid into swim school.
If you want
school.
A beer on poolside when you're on holiday, that's the reason you should get your kids in the pool.
I think that's enough of a reason. Definitely works for me.
James, we've got, of course, not the Olympics, the marathon coming up this weekend on, is it Sunday?
Yes.
Saturday or Sunday?
Sunday,
isn't it? As a professional athlete, what kind of thing do you think people should be doing in this week leading up to what's probably one of the biggest events of their lives?
What do you mean, the marathon runners?
Yeah, so what kind of, before a competition or before a race, do you need more sleep? Do you need to eat more?
Well, I mean, to be fair, I don't know how marathon runners train that much, and I don't 100% sure know what they eat. I mean, I'm guessing because they're a marathon runners, they'll hit the carbohydrates quite high. But these guys and these ladies, these gentle ladies, they'll have done it like hundreds of times. And they'll have their own little routine, and they'll, like I said before, they won't change anything. They won't do anything different. So if I can give them some advice, just do what you always do. Don't, you don't need to eat anything different, or, you don't go, if you're not used to maybe eating, say, seafood, don't go to the in the village. Don't go to the
no.
You know,
I,
the
I think that,
and like
that's probably
eat
fair enough.
Monkfish or something, you know.
Monkfish.
So it's about sticking to what you know, sticking to your plan. And these guys will have trained, you know, millions and millions of hours, and you know, had loads and loads of chats with their coaches about their race plans and race techniques, and you know how they're going to pace the race. I'm sure. So they'll have it in the head. It's just about keeping illness free, keeping injury free, making sure you get good rest, eating the right things, and these guys will be absolutely great.
Okay, well, speaking of stick to what you know, let's go to some Commonwealth Games. Were you watching the Commonwealth Games?
I did. You know what? I didn't watch as much as I'd like. I watched most of the swimming, but my favourite competition so far was the netball. Absolutely loved the netball.
Brilliant.
My daughter started playing netball as well, and the girls' netball was unbelievable. I had such a good time watching it, and I never thought I would, but it was absolutely fantastic. Loved it.
What do you think about the head coach Tracy Neville saying that the funding is still a noose around our neck? That's her her quote, as it were. Last February, netball was awarded £13.9 million for development and £3 million to the national team. What is it about funding and sport, I guess, in general, and especially the sports that compete, like you say, in the Olympics, in the Commonwealth? Is there enough funding to go around?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure exactly what the numbers are with all the funding, but it's kind of that cliche, isn't it? Because the better a sport does, the more funding it needs, and the worse a sport does, obviously they get funding cuts. But then there's the, you know, people have the arguments of, well, you know, if they're not that good, then maybe they need more funding to get good. So it's kind of like, for some sports, it might be a bit of a downward spiral. Like, the worse they get, the less funding they get, then the worse they get, and you know, it keeps going down and down. Hopefully, you know, with these girls doing this so well in netball, it was so exciting. They beat, what was it, Jamaica in the semis by one, beating Australia on home soil by one point in the last
Amazing.
Second of the game was just so exciting. Hopefully, you know, that'll kickstart some funding for those guys. It's a tricky question. It's, you know, it's a debate that maybe needs to take a little bit longer than right now, but it's tough. You know, like I said, the teams that do really well get the top funding, the ones that do really bad get the worst funding, and I don't know. It's
a hard
it's
one.
Two sides to a coin. It's quite tricky.
And what swimmer stood out for you?
What swimmers?
If you watched, you're glued to the swimming. So who stood out for you the most?
Yeah. Are we talking specifically England here?
No.
Like,
Put your Commonwealth hat on.
I'm like England all the way. Like, I want to beat the Scots just as much as I want to beat the Aussies.
Yeah.
Like, if not, I want to beat the Scots more, because like a lot of them are on my team at the, you know, when we represent GB. So I almost want to beat those guys even more. Duncan Scott for Scotland was absolutely phenomenal at this competition. He won, I think, was it 6 medals? I think he got a gold,
amazing,
silver, and 4 bronze.
Such talent.
He had an amazing competition. Who else was great? James Wilby won the 2 meters breaststroke for England. He was fantastic as well. That was kind of like his breakthrough swim. When I won it in 2002, I won the 2 meters backstroke. That was kind of like my breakthrough swim, where I kind of like burst onto the scene, you know, in the senior team, in the senior ranks. So he dropped like 1 or 2 seconds off his best time, won that 2 meters breaststroke. That's kind of like put him up there in the world now, and that'll be him like cemented on the senior team for a while now. So he had a really good breakthrough swim. Whoever for the girls, Amy Wilmot won gold in the 400 IM. She was fantastic as well. Hannah Miley was probably, you know, ranked first, or, you know, favourited first to win that. And Amy Wilmot kind of just got in there and beat it by like 0.1, 0.2 of a second. So she did amazing as well. If we go foreign, we had Chadler Clarcy, won everything pretty much. What did he win? 1500, 200 fly. It was great. I mean, the thing that I was a little bit gutted about actually was watching, I mean, my event that I won was the 2 meters backstroke. And I watched the Aussies win 1, 2, 3 in the 2 meters backstroke. And it was just like, I just saw some pictures on Twitter of like, they won 1, 2, 3 for the men's backstroke, and they got a gold, silver, bronze in one of the women's events as well. And there was like a picture of them together, and it was just like, ugh, that was just horrible. I was like, I wanted to put some like red and white in that picture so badly. but yeah, it was great. And something that I loved as well was the outdoor swimming pool. Loved it. I think it's because they don't have it at major competitions now with FINA. They kind of, after 2009, I think was the last competition, they don't have outdoor swimming competitions anymore. And I think it's a real shame. And
why don't they?
I'm not sure. I'm not 100% sure.
Would it not be affected very much by the weather? I suppose Australia is a little bit more
forgiving.
Sort of placid.
Yes.
Yeah, if you were to have an outdoor swimming pool in, say, England, you might well be facing rain, wind. It can really depend on the day. And some people might be better equipped at that.
It's a good point.
So it's an unfair advantage. Yeah. Although, to be fair, it would probably be the English who are really good at adverse weather conditions. So maybe we should be campaigning
for that.
This is
what we need to do.
Yeah.
We're missing something.
I'm all for it. I definitely preferred the warmer weather, 100%. I mean, that's why I used to love going on training camps. You know, one of my favourite training camps was to South Africa every year. Wow. And honestly, I would, like, my performances would go up at least 10% in training. It was so, so great. But I loved the pool on the Gold Coast. It was so refreshing. And one of the, if not one, at least one of the evenings, there was it was raining. And I thought, it just makes it a little bit different. It gives it a bit more of a bit of a twist on things. And it was, the pool would look absolutely phenomenal.
Well, I have to say, I will wholeheartedly agree with you. I think my performance at anything goes up about 10% in the sun or in a warmer climate.
Yes, very well said. James, what are you working on at the moment? Are you going back out to do any more summer camps?
Fingers crossed, yeah. We've still got some stuff going out in Thailand, working with a couple of schools out there with their training programs and their learn to swim programs. Over here, I do lots of swimming events, and I coach at my local club a few nights a week, 3-4 nights a week. So it's just everything to do with swimming at the minute. That's what I do. It's kind of all I know, really. Like, you know, if you want to know about swimming strokes and swimming technique, like, I know everything with, like, the back of my hand. So it's swimming's where it's at for me.
Brilliant.
Yeah, so for sure.
Basically, I'll do a call out for our viewers. Anyone wants to know about swimming or swimming techniques, just slide into James's DMs. Is that right?
This is it, yeah.
Perfect, James. Sorted.
Yeah, there's jokes all over the place there, but I'll save it.
I'm trying to keep quiet as well. James, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
You've brightened up our afternoon.
Yeah, thank you, James.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah. Thank you. Anytime.
Have a wonderful week, James.
Bye, guys.
Take
care.
Nice to speak
to you again, Rachel.
Yeah, you too. Hope your week goes with a bang, James.
Bye.
Men are really bad at signing off on the phone, aren't they? My dad does that. He says bye, bye, bye about 5 times before he actually gets off the phone. Thank you, though, James. A great little insight into Commonwealth and Olympic life. And, yeah, I think we all should go and get in the pool and then ask for some tips.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'm. Do you know what? I'm a rubbish swimmer. I'm
Are
really,
you?
Really bad. Yeah, I don't think I've even had a proper swimming lesson. I think my parents probably did what James said. I had a beer. Off you go, Rachel.
See, I definitely did swimming lessons, and I can remember doing I think it was like the 600 metres you'd get your whale badge, or like the 800 metres you'd get your dolphin badge, various things. But
ooh,
I think that's probably the competitive side of me.
Yeah,
because
I think
when we were speaking to Becky and she was saying how bad it is that there's not enough teaching of swimming with young people, I think probably that is a huge element of it. If kids aren't competitive, if they don't have that drive to want to do it, why would they?
Yeah, it's true. And I agree with that. Like I said, I never had proper swimming lessons, and I can be quite scared of like deep water and James Goddard, do check him out. Thank you so much for talking to us.
So straight from swimming and into weightlifting, yesterday I caught up with Ryan Terry, who I believe is now in LA. I think he was going straight to Heathrow to get on a flight, lucky thing. He is the UK's highest profile physique athlete, and he's also a Mr. Olympia runner-up. He's going for his third time at Mr. Olympia, the last time he came sixth, which is a huge, huge, huge achievement, especially for a UK athlete. And he is also an ambassador of USN, which is a leading sports nutrition brand, not band. Here's what he had to say. We are at Fight City Gym, and we're here to talk about fitness, nutrition, a little bit about you, because you had quite a cool introduction into fitness, didn't you? So how did you get into it?
So I've trained since I was 14, did a lot of sports when I was younger, so I used to swim at a national level, gymnastics and football at a national level. So I used to love sports, and I got an injury on my Achilles, and I gained a lot of weight, obviously, not doing anything, very sedentary. So then when I was 14, I had to go to the gym and basically lose the body fat, lose the weight. That's how I got into the gym, and that's how I started to love bodybuilding and fitness as a whole. For 5 years, 6 years, I was a plumber, working on site, 12-hour days, and I was a gas engineer, so fitting central heating, bathrooms, things like that. So I used to do my cardio at 5 in the morning before I got on site, and I used to do my weight training at, say, 8, 9 o'clock at night when I finished. So there were long days, and it was just a hobby for me. I didn't realise this world existed, like the sports world, and it was only when I was 20 when it all changed for me, and I started to look down the competing route.
You came into it through an injury, and presumably
that must have had some of an impact sort of on your psychology.
That's exactly what it was. So for me, I had a bit of a complex about being overweight, and that's why I got into the gym, to lose the body fat quickly and to just sculpt my body and to get that confidence back. And the reason I stepped on stage was exactly that again. It was something where I wanted to step out of my comfort zone. I'd never show anybody my body with my top off, and it was just something I wanted to say I'd done once. I wanted to see if I had the determination and the motivation and the discipline to do a bodybuilding show and to face my fear, which was taking my top off in front of people. I only ever said I was going to do it once. Picked a local show to me, which I now realise was as a national show. Yeah, when I won that, it obviously skyrocketed in the right way.
And Now you are, is it your third time at Mr. Olympia?
Yeah. I've done three now, yeah.
Done three, so it's your fourth.
Yeah, I've qualified for the fourth time.
How do you prepare for something like that? Because it must be quite a grueling thing to put your body through.
Yeah, it's pretty intense. Like I say, I normally compete at the start of the year and at the end of the year, so I do the two biggest shows in the world, which is the Arnold Classic, Arnold Schwarzenegger's show, and the Olympia, which is the world's biggest show. So that's in Las Vegas and Columbus, so they're both in America. But it is taxing, but I really enjoy that. I thrive on that because I like dieting. When I'm in a deficit, calorie deficit, when I'm pushing myself in the gym, more extremes, I feel at home then, and I feel better in myself. So it is hard. 12 weeks of hard graft, every calorie counts, every expenditure of calorie counts when you're in the gym. It is quite intense.
So how do you keep on track of that?
It just comes with experience. Obviously, I've been competing now for 8 years, and each competition, each prep, I change something different to see if I can improve. And that's what bodybuilding is about, is taking what you've got, changing the little things and seeing if you can improve. Mm-hmm. You can't do it overnight, and it does take time. So this shows where I've come in too quick, and I'm 4 weeks out and I'm ready, which is not ideal, because you're then in a deficit and you're starting to lose muscle as well as body fat. But it's just trying to time your foods right, your training sessions around that 12-week prep.
So if we're talking about something like a marathon, for example, which is coming up this weekend, you have to be very careful about how much protein you're consuming and getting the right mix of protein and carbs before and after. Is that something that you have to think about?
Oh yeah, unbelievably, yeah. So that's very specific to an individual. So bodybuilding is a lifestyle which you can't learn overnight, and you've got to basically find out what works for your individual metabolism in your body. So I've got things wrong before where I'm under-caloried in certain things, where I start to lose body fat as well as muscle tissue. And it comes with, like I say, more experience. Then I have to have specific amounts of protein. So for every kilogram I weigh, I have 2 grams of protein per day. So if I'm weighing, on stage I weigh 90 kilograms, so I would be consuming around that time 180 grams of protein, 180 grams.
Wow, that's a lot of protein.
That
feels like a lot of protein to me. Let's visualise this. What would 180 grams of protein look like? Is that a chicken?
It's a bit more than that. Yeah, it's definitely more than that. So a chicken breast is around 50 grams.
Okay. Breast. So it might be a whole big chicken.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, you meant the whole chicken. Yeah. So you could do that, yeah. And it's not mass amounts, but some people get it wrong. Where with bodybuilding, the mentality is more protein, more muscle, and that's not correct. You've got to have a balance. So for me, my protein stays the same all year, no matter what the goal. I don't go in a surplus or too much calories or too many protein, because I'll just basically waste it. My body will just flush it out, or it'll store as fat. For me, it's about carbs and and fats, where I differ through the years, depending on what my end goal is.
So if you're training harder, that will be more carbs?
So if I'm on an off season, I'm trying to grow, I'll increase my calories through fats and carbs just to fuel my workouts, to increase my body fat, which is going to help my workouts and help me grow. So your body is in more of an anabolic state when you've got more calories in it and you've got more body fat, so you can grow quicker, hence the old bodybuilding method where you see they look fat but there is muscle underneath it, and what they're doing is making sure they've got enough body fat to grow muscle quicker.
Interesting, because they do say that abs are made in the kitchen, and there's all this theory that actually we all have abs, we've all got a banging body, it's just whether or not it's hidden under a bit of fat.
That is true, yeah. And for a man, it's particularly hard, because a male holds on their midsection and their lower back, whereas a woman normally holds on their glutes and their hamstrings and their legs. So for a male, when you say abs are made in the kitchen, that's correct. But when you diet down, you can train as hard as you want, but if you're not losing body fat, or you're not supplement the right diet with your training, then you're not going to reveal your abs. No, you can train as hard as you want.
Can't out-train a bad diet.
Hey, that's it.
I know, I've got all the phrases. So just very quickly, let's talk about supplements, because okay. It's been in the press recently whether or not we should be taking supplements, whether we should be able to get everything from food. But obviously at the very end of the extreme is someone like you, who is a professional athlete. What are your views on supplements?
Yeah, so I would always say, even though I'm sponsored by a supplement company and I've been with them for 8 years, I would always say food, solid food, is more important than any other diet. Mm. Supplements are there to supplement a balanced diet.
So clues in the name.
Exactly, yeah. So it's key to get all your solid meals in, get a good amount of protein, carbs, fats, fibres, living that healthy lifestyle. And supplements are brilliant for when you're trying to push through plateaus and for the absorption rate. So in the day, first thing in the morning, you've fasted over 8 hours, you've slept for 8 hours, your body needs food and needs fuel as soon as possible. So with your first meal, that's why they say breakfast is one of your main, most important meals of the day. And that's so right in the fact that you want to get all your the food digested and used as fuel as soon as possible. So oats are good, so high glycemic, you're going to get energy for the day, you've got fats in there as well. And protein is ideal at that time. So a whey protein, which you're going to get through powders, it digests within 1 hour into the system, whereas a chicken breast or a steak can take, or a chicken breast or turkey breast, is 3 to 4 hours.
So do you want it to be longer, or do you want it to be quicker?
First thing in the morning, I want it to be quicker, and post-workout. So the absorption rate is vital post-workout. So when you've depleted all your glycogen and you're tired from training, it's important to get the nutrients back in as quick as possible, because you've got an anabolic window of 30 minutes. So once you consume your protein or whatever you're going to take post-workout, that's going to aid the recovery quicker, and it's digested within an hour, whereas food takes 3 to 4 hours. So there is science behind supplements. It's not,
it's
like
quite a lot of science. I feel like I want to take some notes.
Yeah, but there is a lot to it, and but people do get carried away. There's so many supplements out there, there's so many different brands bringing out all these innovative tablets, which is not, I wouldn't advise
marketing
that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for me it's important to get a good whey protein, BCAA, just to aid your recovery whilst you're training, and that's it really, that's as far as you need to go, and focus on the food. You can get a lot of nutrients, or most of your nutrients, through food. There's just certain things where you're, if you're trying to train at a high level, or if you're trying to push yourself and trying to improve yourself past limits, then that is going to help you.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Ryan, thank you very much.
No,
I think
problem.
You're off to LA now.
I am, yes.
Going to Heathrow right now.
Yes, from
I'm
here.
Very glad we caught you. Thank you so much.
I appreciate that. No, thank you for having me.
That was a brilliant interview there. Ryan Terry, by our wonderful Olivia Cox.
Thank you.
You could tell that he was like, yeah, I've got to go Heathrow.
I know.
Olivia,
literally, as soon as I sat down, it was like, bums on seats. By the way, did you know I'm going to LA in a couple of hours? Oh.
All right.
Okay. I'll do this quick.
So jealous. Well, yes, that was our Ryan Terry interview. We're just going to take a little breather, and we're going to have all the latest fitness stories coming up after this.
FUBAR Radio presents Harriet Rose.
I'm joined by the wonderful SG Lewis.
Hi. Meeting Farrar was the mad one. He's flawless. He's just like an ageless being. He has this presence. Whenever he walks into a room, it's like everyone's just like, God, it's Farrar. When he speaks to you, it's like there's no one else in the room. Oh, he just came up to me. He's like, hey, I don't believe we've met. And I was like, and he was like, thank you for the beautiful music. And I was like, and this guy.
And then you died.
And then I died.
But it was a good way to die.
Yeah.
If anything, you'd achieved all you needed
to. Exactly. I only ever came here to impress Pharrell. So.
Every Thursday, Harriet Rose from 4 p.m. FUBAR Radio.
Yep, this is FUBAR Radio. This is Pitch Talk. I'm Rachel Downey. I've got my wonderful Olivia Cox.
Hello.
I like that. Hello.
That was my best accent. Do you ever find it when you're either when you pick up the phone to an unknown caller, or if you're speaking to an adult? Or if you're drunk and trying to pretend to be sober, you get very, very posh. Is that just me?
No, I do that too.
Suddenly I enunciate the hell out of everything. Like, T's that I never knew existed start flying out my mouth.
Especially when I'm drunk and you try so hard to overpronounce everything because I'm sober. I'm so sober.
Yeah, because you are definitely not going to slur. Oh. A few people who are definitely not going to be getting drunk this week are the London Marathon runners, because, of course, it's the marathon on Sunday. Now, it's being started by the Queen. She's going to be pressing a button.
Queenie.
From Windsor Castle.
Good old Queenie.
There's been some speculation about whether or not she would show at the actual marathon. I'm going to hedge a bet and say that is hugely unlikely. Mainly because there are more than 40,000 people taking part, and of course the streets of London will be paved
paved? Paved, lined.
I think they're paved.
They'll be lined. You try saying that again.
It's hard with my horse teeth.
Rachel.
Horse teeth.
They will be lined with people watching. And in the men's elite, Mo Farah will make his first appearance since switching to road racing. And in the women's elite, three-time winner Mary Keitany.
Just say it.
Keitany.
Do it quick, that's what I do.
Is eyeing up the world record.
Have you ever done? You've done the marathon, haven't you?
Yeah, I did it in 2012.
What was that like?
You know, when I asked people before I did it, everyone said, "Oh, I don't remember. I can't really remember."
Like giving birth.
But yeah, I think you repress the bad bits because I remember vividly that every step. Oh, sorry, if you're about to do the marathon, maybe switch off because this might scare you. After 18 miles, every step hurt. However.
That's a crazy.
My main memory is crossing the finish line. I really remember I walked up to get my medal because you're sort of churned along in a conveyor belt, like, stand there, have a photo, take your medal, go! Because there's 40,000 people.
Oh, that's a good point.
And the guy giving me my medal was shimmying me along because I'd stopped to tie my hair up. And he said, it's all right, love, you can do your hair when you get through. And I was like, hang on.
How far have you run? Yeah. How far have I just run?
Talk to me when you've run 26.2 miles. But obviously, being British, I went, okay, I'm really sorry.
Yes.
So that was my marathon experience. But it's incredible. The atmosphere is amazing.
Really?
I didn't see anyone along the way. I was listening to rather loud music, which I'm not really meant to do, but I wanted to keep going.
That's what I would do, just to stay very focused.
Exactly.
The minute I stopped to wave to someone or...
Yeah. Or you try and like look pretty for a photo, it's game over.
Yeah.
The worse you look in your marathon pictures, the better you'll do.
Well, that's very promising for a lot of the people out there. Very promising.
So, yeah, that is happening.
How much training do you have to do? Do you have to do like months and months in advance?
Most people start training in October.
Oh, okay. So it's not...
Yeah. But the trouble is, and Ryan touched on this a little bit yesterday, you don't want to peak too soon because if you get to your optimum fitness and you're absolutely ready to go with a couple of weeks or months left, what do you do then? You then have to maintain that. You're very at risk of injury because you're pushing yourself consistently. What you want to achieve is getting to around the 18, 19, 20 mile points. So you've still got six on the day at least. That will be your final training run about a week before. And then the week prior to the marathon is just about ticking over. It's like revising for an exam. By that point, you're not going to know any more.
It's true.
You're not going to get any better at running in a week. So chill, let your body relax, don't risk an injury, and just focus on eating. And that was hands down my favourite part of the marathon was my carbo loading.
I was going to say, did you literally carb up like you've never carbed before?
Now, I was absolutely terrified that I'd do a Paula Radcliffe. So I banned fruit, anything high in fibre, anything chilly or spicy that
you
might...
Don't want any movement. No.
I absolutely did not want that. But there is... It's an amazing achievement. And of course, it's not just the sporting achievement for yourself. It's also charity. And there's a huge trend this year for military support. There's three that have stood out to me. There's a man racing as a giant poppy, literally... A giant poppy.
How do you even run like a poppy?
I'm not sure. I think you might have to waddle like
That's
a poppy.
That's amazing.
There's a currently serving sergeant who's aiming to break Guinness Book... Guinness World Book? World Guinness... He's aiming to break a record.
Amazing.
For the fastest marathon in a suit of armour.
Wow, that's incredible.
Which I think is pretty punchy.
And especially with the heat.
Well, apparently it's going to be one of the hottest marathons on record. It's going to be something like 21 degrees. And finally, Captain Dutch, who's running for Just Rifles, has got three outfit changes, which...
Oh, my God.
I love. But it's to represent the British Army soldiers who've been killed and wounded in action since the start of the 2001 conflict. So there are all sorts of reasons that people run the marathon.
It's incredible.
Good luck to everybody.
Yeah, it really is. And sometimes when you see, like, bless them, I know when we haven't actually touched on this, when we did Tough Mudder. And we did Tough Mudder!
When we did 5K...
Do not ruin this.
Compared to 45, is it, about the marathon?
Maths has never been my strong point.
Okay.
And you see the people dressed up and everything, and then once, obviously, they start running, they probably realise, this was, like being in the back of a horse, for instance. This is more difficult
I have to
than
say, there is nothing more demoralising, though, than being overtaken by a fairy or Superman or something.
A wheelbarrow.
Cape flapping in the wind in your face. You're like, cheers, mate.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much. I agree. I think it's incredible what they're doing. It still scares me. I'd like to do it one... Would you do it again?
I'd do another marathon. I would never do London again.
Why?
Too competitive. I would hate the feeling that I needed to beat my own time.
Oh, you're too competitive. Yeah. I thought you meant it was too competitive.
No, I'm too competitive. I would quite like to do New York purely because my dad's done it.
Okay.
And I want to beat him.
Yeah. You can see a pattern with Olivia. You can see why she's in sport, can't you?
Yeah,
absolutely perfect. Now, two-time Olympian Desiree Linden became the first American woman to win the Boston Marathon since 1985, yesterday. But the person making all the headlines at the moment is the runner-up. Sarah Sellers ran the 26.2-mile course in a time of 2 hours, 44 minutes, 4 seconds, finishing minutes behind Linden. Making headlines because she's a nurse. 26-year-old nurse.
Hang on, why does that make headlines?
Because I think you've got like an Olympian
winning. Oh, I see.
Winning.
She was
an
amateur.
Then, yes.
Oh, yes, good point.
The first in Utah, she won to qualify for the prestigious Boston event. A keen track and field competitor in college, but is an unknown to the professional running world. Previous injuries meant she'd stopped competing. The nurse only signed up for Monday's event because her younger brother was participating. That's incredible.
Oh my God, can you imagine your younger brother being like, I'm doing the marathon, I think you should too.
And you're like, oh, all right, whatever.
And then you go and smash his time. Good girl.
I mean, that's incredible. So yeah, well done to all those that took part in the Boston Marathon as well. So maybe you should do the Boston Marathon too.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe, Rach.
Maybe, maybe not. There is, of course, another marathon runner in the news today or throughout the week because, sadly, there was an accident in the... in the marathon during the Commonwealth Games. Scotland's Callum Hawkins was just over a mile from the finish line when he collapsed. He has been released from hospital. That was on Sunday. But there's going to be a bit of an investigation because there is questions over whether there was an excessive delay in getting to him by medical staff, which seems a bit unusual to me. If he was that close to the finish line, you'd think that would be one of the most populated... Yeah. Areas. What a shame for Callum Hawkins. And hopefully everyone taking part in the London Marathon will have read the weather forecast because it is going to be hot.
How do you stay... Oh, this is going to sound really ridiculous. How do you stay cool when you know you've got that coming up and you know the weather is... No one was expecting it to be this hot coming up on Sunday. What do you do? Because you're going to be exhausted. You're
you know,
be hot.
I think the thing you've got to really think about is adjusting your kit. And the difficulty is that now I know James Goddard said, do everything you're used to, set a routine. The trouble with the London Marathon, and I really think that they should be changing when in the year they do the London Marathon, is England is cold. It is cold and wet through the winter. And then traditionally in May or April, you get these freak hot days.
Yeah.
Now, I started training quite late, probably around Christmas of 2011. And it was absolutely freezing. I remember going out for runs in the dark and the pouring rain, hail, everything.
That's horrendous.
And then all of a sudden on the day, it was suddenly roasting. So there is, I think there does need to be a discussion here. We'll wait and see what happens this Sunday. Hopefully nothing goes wrong. But I think it is quite, it's late in April for a marathon to be happening where most people have trained through the winter. Most people are used to wearing layers to train, stay warm, probably not having to take on as much water, so they won't be used to needing water. So there's a severe risk of dehydration.
Yeah, and like you say, like these could be people's first marathons. These aren't like professional people that do this all the time. Obviously, there'll be people that do marathons all the time, but there'll be people that it'll be their first time they're doing something like this, you know? So, yeah, it's going to be... Yeah, it will be a great, great day. Mm. Are you going to go down and watch?
I am. I definitely am. I love the marathon. It's a great atmosphere. And there's so many nice stories that come out of this, out of the marathon, bringing everyone together. There's a medical lecturer, Tim Marshall, who lost the use of his legs in a climbing accident in the 80s. And he was part of the sort of campaign that led to the London Marathon allowing wheelchairs. Now, it had never occurred to me that they wouldn't have allowed disabled races.
No, do you know what? I've never thought about.
Yeah,
I assume
because now they happen. There's the way it all starts these days. The elite wheelchairs start the race first. Then there's a group of elite blind and amputee runners, and then it sort of trickles back to non-elite, and then we go into the elite men's, elite women's, and then everybody else. It was only in 83. That they allowed wheelchairs to take part. And it was some crazy reason, like health and safety, that they said it couldn't. But other marathons around the globe, and even different ones in England, just not the London Marathon, were allowing them. So it's good that we allow them now.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we spoke about this. It might have been around Christmas time. And I can't remember the year on top of my head, but only women were allowed to take part in a marathon, I think, in the 80s.
Yeah.
Or it could even be the 90s. It's something ridiculous like that. It's, yeah. And it's about those people just making a stand and making a statement. But, yeah, if... And, you know, viewers, whoever is watching the marathon on Sunday, do tweet us and let us know what you thought, and we will read your tweet out on the show.
Do indeed. Now, another little bit of controversy for you before we look at wrapping up the show. Ian... No... Israel Folau has been cleared by Rugby Australia after he made some pretty bad anti-gay remarks on his Instagram page. Now, this is 2 weeks ago. He's an evangelical Christian, and he wrote that gay people would be condemned to hell if they failed to repent. Now, to me, Rugby Australia saying that he won't face sanctions, that they understand his reasoning because of his faith... I don't think that's right.
You can't say something like that and then put a caveat of, oh, because I'm religious, or, oh, because... No, it doesn't... Yeah. It's horrendous. And it's bizarre that they have let him off. And, you know, even if they say, yeah, it is because of his religious beliefs, but don't you... Then he should keep it quiet. Keep it behind closed doors.
You know, I am wondering if maybe this has something to do... Well, not something to do with, but in the current climate in Australia of sport, you look at cricket, you've got that controversy. There's another thing coming up. I wonder if they're actually aiming just to push it under the rug. They're hoping that the UK press, everyone else, won't pick up on it. They've got too much bad press at the moment. But even still, this is setting a precedent because it's been a long time coming that... sexuality, race, issues like that have been accepted a lot more in sport, and we've got such a long way to go. It's such a shame to see someone in a position of influence doing that.
And you know what, for a sports person, rugby player, footballer, to actually come out is very, very tough. And when you've got things like this going on, and then you see the board hide it, it's putting the sport back.
It's a bad precedent
years.
To set.
Yeah.
My other little bit of news is that a Russian bear stunt has been condemned by animal welfare group PETA, P-E-T-A. Mm-hmm. And this is after a Russian football team used a real bear as part of their pre-match entertainment. This is horrific and shouldn't be allowed. And hopefully we will not see it in... Russia is hosting the Football World Cup in June. I think that starts on the 14th.
Yep, 14th of June.
And there's been some fears that actually because... the bear is a national symbol of Russia. People are a little bit worried that this might be almost a practice run for the opening ceremony.
They just couldn't do it.
No.
They couldn't.
FIFA has denied claims that this might be used. So it's pretty much been rubbish.
Can't.
But even so, it is not a good... Poor bear.
It's like we're looking at something from the 40s or the 50s.
What is wrong with news
I
today?
I don't understand! right, we've only got about 2 minutes left, Olivia.
Yeah.
Should we talk? Rach, do you want to catch up, babe? We're on a radio show. The Fitbit.
Yes.
News.
So the Fitbit has been in the news today. In fact, for a little while, a lot of Instagram models love the Fitbit.
They do.
It's been reported that NHS staff are not allowed to wear them because they're unhygienic and store germs. And some of the NHS workers have actually been trying to bend this rule by wearing them on their ankles, presumably because you won't see them there. Or during their breaks, sticking them on. I know.
You don't need to hide it. Isn't
well, because it's
banned. One of those prison tags that you've got to hide. I mean,
but it's because it's been banned by the NHS. And I thing is, I kind of understand this, but surely it's the same as wearing a watch.
Good point.
Yeah.
So maybe it's because they run, sweat in it. I don't really know.
But don't people run and sweat in their watch?
I mean, it's
I don't
bizarre.
Know. I'm a little bit confused about this. And then there's also relating to Fitbit. Wondering whether or not employers should be giving Fitbits out. There's a bit of a fear. I think it was PwC who a lot of the staff said that they wouldn't trust their employers having their data because they would snoop on them. I'm not sure how much data Fitbit takes, and I think
I'm not sure.
Probably
it's not Facebook.
It's not, but no. I think we're pretty safe on the data thing with Fitbit. I don't know. Famous last words.
But PwC, I think you might be all right for another day.
Yeah, I think that they're being a little bit over aware there. But the growth in workplace fitness is really stimulating this rise because officers are giving incentives and they're trying to get their employees to be more active. A lot of officers offer a gym membership. And of course, I think it's Barclays makes people stay at their desk they have a sensor.
Oh my God, and my sister's work, we'll talk more about this next week, they have a weigh-in every week.
Stop.
Horrendous.
That's not allowed.
That's my idea of hell. That's my idea of hell. Olivia, that's it of our show.
Time flies, I have to say. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
It's like she's collecting her Oscar. Have the most... I'd like to thank my mum, my dad. Have the most amazing week. We shall see you next Tuesday, 4 till 5 at Pitch Talk.
See ya.
Bye.
This past hour, you've been listening to Pitch Talk with Rachel Downey and Olivia Cotts. To listen again, simply go to foobarradio.com or our app where this episode and all past episodes are free to stream or download. Send all questions, comments or queries to pitch@foobarradio.com or tweet @foobarradio.